From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tomorrow marks the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, the Nazi death camp in Poland that has come to symbolize the terror and genocide of the Holocaust. Auschwitz is the site of the greatest mass murder in history. Some 1.5 million people, most of them Jews from across Europe, died at Auschwitz and the neighboring Birkenau camp before the camps were liberated by the Soviet Red Army on January 27, 1945. Most died in gas chambers. Tomorrow, about 40 heads of state will gather at the site, including the presidents of France, Germany, Israel, Poland, and Russia. Vice President Dick Cheney will represent the United States. Tonight, we will hear the voices, the memories, and the views today of three remarkable women who survived Auschwitz. They were children when the Nazis came to power, 10, 13, and 14 when they entered Auschwitz. Each survived against the most daunting odds. 60 years later, they still wonder how they escaped death, how as children they had the will to keep fighting to live, and how humans could carry out the unthinkable nightmare of the Holocaust, carry out genocide then and now. This hour On Point, the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. The first of the women I spoke with was survivor Sonia Schreiber-Weitz. She was born in Krakow, Poland. She was sent to Auschwitz in December 1944. She was 13. Auschwitz was one of five concentration camps she survived. A poet, she now lives in Peabody, Massachusetts, and is founder of the Holocaust Center Boston North. She was finally liberated in May 1945 from the Mauthausen camp near Linz, Austria. I asked her about the day her camp was liberated and about one soldier in particular that she remembers.
The barracks I was in were a pretty sad lot of us. Most of us were very sick and dying. And one day I just looked up and there was this big, beautiful black soldier. And my state of mind, I guess, more dead than alive, I thought he was the Messiah. And I eventually wrote a poem to honor him.
You called it My Black Messiah.
My Black Messiah.
You said a black GI stood by the door. I never saw a black before. He'll set me free before I die. I thought he must be the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
But you were in a terrible state, maybe, what, 60, 70 pounds at that
right.
point?
Actually, I weighed under 60 pounds. And I do remember the horror on his face, and I describe it in the poem. The GIs who liberated us were totally devastated by the sight.
You said the shock, the horror on his face, he didn't weep, he didn't cry, but deep within his gentle eyes, a flood of devastating pain, his innocence forever slain. You were a girl, just a teenager at that time. By the time you were liberated, your own innocence must have been left far behind.
Yes, I'm afraid so. I think it has. I've desperately tried to redeem some of it. And I do. I am a rather optimistic and hopeful person, or I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. This education and this hope that perhaps we'll learn something from it. So, yes, but I think my innocence was totally slaughtered.
By the time you were freed, and this was in the Mauthausen camp, you'd been in five camps, including, of course, Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen. You'd grown up in Krakow. How did you survive? Why did you survive?
That's a very difficult question. I think most survivors agree that survival was dumb luck. I know people don't want to hear that. They'd like to hear some wonderful story mm-hmm. that I was stronger or more brave or in some way different. I wasn't. It was really dumb luck. Now, in my case, I survived with my sister. My sister Blanca was always there protecting me and finding that extra piece of bread and keeping me alive in general, just keeping me alive. Only the two of us out of a family of 84 survived.
You remember being taken to Auschwitz at the end of 1944 around Christmas time. You've said that you remember the Christmas decorations going up.
Yes, there was some decorations and people were sort of rushing around and there was a feeling of normalcy. Of course, nobody even attempted to help us. I'm not sure what exactly they could have done to help us, but we were a pretty sorry-looking lot, and people just stared at us and went about their own business. We walked to Auschwitz from Plaszów.
You were 13. Your sister was 21. By this point, it was nearing the end of the war. The Soviets would soon be knocking at the door of Auschwitz. In your time there, short as it was, what was the content of your days?
My memories of Auschwitz are being very cold and very wet. And I remember the selections. Now, actually, we were in Birkenau. Birkenau was the death camp of Auschwitz. And the selections were horrifying.
You mean the selections for who would die on any given day?
At any given time. Just standing there naked, shivering, waiting to be told to go to the right or to the left.
And you knew each time that it was an issue of living or dying.
For me, at that point, I don't think I was analyzing that. I think it was just a matter of life and death not to be separated from my sister. And we cheated in many ways. I made myself older and she made herself younger, and I even changed my name to hers in the beginning, hoping we would not be separated.
And then came the day, as the Soviet forces approached, when you were taken out of Auschwitz and put on a death march to Bergen-Belsen. Describe that for us.
Well, that is probably the most horrifying of all my experiences. It was, you know, the weather. I went out for a little bit today, and I'm thinking, you know, how wonderful to come back to my wonderful, warm apartment. Mm. It was snow and ice, and the roads were very slippery, and the guards were very cruel. We were starving, and we wore mostly rags. I don't know if it was days or weeks, actually a lifetime. But sometimes they would let us rest when the guards were tired and they were well-dressed, mostly drunk, on horseback. They letting us rest in the snow. My sister wouldn't let me sleep. Blanka somehow realized or learned that it was very easy to die in the snow.
You set off from Auschwitz with about 300 women. You walked a long way. You were finally put on cattle cars. How many were alive when you reached Bergen-Belsen?
I remember about 300 of us taken to Bergen-Belsen. Mm. Eventually, 30 of us made it out of Bergen-Belsen, and 5 of us survived.
Among your many poems, you've written one about that march. I wonder if you could read it for us.
Okay. The Death March. A night, a storm, our blood still warm, soaking into the snow, our bodies recoil upon frozen soil, oblivious to the flow of pain that whips. Our lifeless lips belie this final hell. At the break of dawn, we barely moan a silent Shema Israel.
Sonia White's reading her poem, The Death March. All these years later, after even that, there's so much life in your voice, and I know how engaged you are in teaching and educating about what happened and the dangers again. How have you dealt with it over the years? How have you lived in spite of those memories?
You know, being a witness, I think, carries special responsibility. And I've been very fortunate with the people around me. And if I can bring that one extra learning piece, because I am a witness, then I can't imagine not doing what I'm doing.
You've said that you're not terribly religious, but you've had some difficult battles with God in your lifetime, trying to understand those events.
I think every survivor has had these kinds of... I think we confronted this now with a tragedy, with a tsunami. It's just people asking what kind of a God would allow this to happen. I mean, if there is a God, then what kind of a God is it? I resolved it in a way that I decided that I was going to stop blaming God, and I was going to blame the bystanders. I can almost come to terms with the victim and the perpetrator, but the bystander, this is what I'm trying to teach, not to stand by. We are learning something, you know, in Bosnia, in Rwanda, well, that was a failure. But we are learning something perhaps about for the Sudan now. So we are very slow, but we're doing more. I would like to think that perhaps the next generation will do even better.
Sonia Weitz, I wonder if you've ever been able to find any of those soldiers who were part of the crew that came in finally to liberate you and your sister.
Well, actually, I found out my little secret about my Black Messiah, and that is that most people argued with me I could not have seen a Black soldier because, shamefully, our armies were segregated. However, it turns out that there were three prisoners of war in Mauthausen. One was Black, and as soon as the army came in, they put a uniform on him, so I was right. There was a Black soldier, and we still haven't given up looking for him. Perhaps your show will be the one. He may listen to it and call me. I would love to be able to honor this man.
From Auschwitz to the Mauthausen camp in 1945, I thought he must be the Messiah, Sonia Weitz writes. Sonia Weitz, thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Sonia Schreiber-Weitz is founder of the Holocaust Center, Boston North. She spoke with me from Peabody, Massachusetts. Joining me now from Washington is Peter Black. He's senior historian at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and former chief historian at the Department of Justice Office of Special Investigations, which was charged with investigating alleged Nazi officials in the United States. Peter Black, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm honored to be here.
We just heard Sonia Weitz's story. We'll hear two more from women, then girls, who were at Auschwitz. Here we are 60 years after the liberation of that camp. Of course, the others liberated over the following 4, 5, 6 months. What's your sense of where the world is in absorbing the meaning of Auschwitz 6 decades after the Holocaust?
One tremendous difference between now and 60 years ago is that Auschwitz, both as a symbol and as a reality, has become a part of the mental furniture of human beings in the 21st century. We know it can happen, and we will no longer have the excuse in the future of saying, well, we didn't know it could happen, or we couldn't conceive of this. Auschwitz certainly was not the last incidence of mass murder, and we have a strong sense now that warning signs can lead to these dark chapters in our history.
It took a long time for the world to take on board what had happened in Europe under the Nazis to understand the Holocaust. Now we're reaching the time when the survivors, here we're talking tonight with people, with women who were just teenagers, not even teenagers in some cases, the witnesses to what happened then are reaching the other end of their lives.
Yes, absolutely. First, in terms of I've had the good fortune and privilege to meet many survivors of the Holocaust, and it's been a significant enrichment of my life, both as a person and as a historian. We're all human beings, and the survivors are as well, and they will pass eventually. And it's our hope that at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, through our archives, through our library, through our outreach programs to various sectors of the community and various professional groups, and through the information that we disseminate to the general public, that we will be able to keep this memory alive. And we urge those who don't want to stand pat with written paper and analysis and scholarship to come to the museum and to see on videotape the survivors tell their stories, much as we have just heard.
We're going to be hearing more stories tonight. We heard there first from Sonia Schreiber-Weitz. 2 of 84 of her family members survived the Holocaust. 60 years ago tomorrow, Auschwitz liberated by the Soviet Red Army. Over the months that followed, American and Soviet forces, some British, liberated camps right across Europe, Eastern Europe, that the Nazis had set up, death camps. I'm joined tonight by Peter Black from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. We've got much more to come in very moving stories from women, then girls, who survived the Holocaust. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz with three women who survived Auschwitz and the Holocaust when they were just children, and with Peter Black, senior historian at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. I spoke earlier to Eva Kor. She was born in Porto, Romania in 1934. At age 10, she was deported to Auschwitz with her twin sister Miriam. They stayed in Auschwitz for 9 months until the camp was liberated. After the war, they moved to Israel and 10 years later to America. Kor spoke with me from Terre Haute, Indiana, where she lives with her husband, also a Holocaust survivor. She's founder of the Holocaust Museum Candles, or Children of Auschwitz Nazi Lab Experiment Survivors. She will be in Auschwitz tomorrow for the 60th anniversary of its liberation. I asked her who in her family died in the Holocaust.
My father, my mother, my two older sisters, my grandparents. My father had 13 brothers and sisters, of whom only three survived. So 10 and their families, their children. My mother had one brother and his children and his wife. So when my twin sister Miriam and I sat down one day many years ago to try to figure out how many might have been in our family who perished, we came up with 117 names that didn't come back.
Can you describe for us, Eva Kor, the last time you saw your mother?
We were in the cattle car train for 4 days. Without water, without any food, without knowing where we were going. And the train stopped. And as it was our custom, when the train stopped, we always asked for water. This time there was no answer in any language, which became clear to me that this must be the final stop. We heard a lot of Germans yelling orders outside. Finally, the cattle car doors slid open and a mass of people poured out. The Nazis were yelling, "Schnell, schnell, raus, raus," which means out.
Mm-hmm.
We stepped down. My mother grabbed my twin sister and me by the hand, hoping that as long as she could hold on to us, she could protect us. We were on that selection platform for 10 minutes when I, in my childish curiosity, since I was 10 years old, looked around to try to figure out what that place was when I realized that my father and my two older sisters disappeared in the crowd. I never saw them again, nor do I have the faintest idea how they died. As we were holding on to my mother, an SS was running on the selection platform yelling in German, "Twins."
As in biological twins, you and your sister.
All he was yelling was "twins, zwillinge, zwillinge." We did not volunteer any information. He noticed us. We were dressed alike, and we looked very much alike, and he approached my mother. He demanded to know if we were twins. My poor mother did not know what to say, so she hesitantly asked if that was good, and the SS nodded yes, and my mother said yes. At that moment, another SS came, pulled my mother in one direction. We were pulled in the opposite direction. We were crying. She was crying. I remember looking back and seeing my mother's arms stretched out in despair as she was pulled away. I never even got to say goodbye to her because this was the last time we saw her. All that took no longer than 30 minutes from the time we stepped down. Miriam and I no longer had a family. We were all alone. We had no idea what would happen to us. And all that was done to us for one single reason, that we were born Jewish. And let me tell you, we did not understand why that was a crime.
You were taken as twins because Joseph Mengele, infamous so-called angel of death, was doing experiments on twins, and you and your sister Miriam became subjects of those experiments.
That's correct. That's correct. Mengele did experiments not only on identical twins. Mengele wanted any kind of twins and any kind of multiples, triplets. One of the reasons was it fit Hitler's ideal they were going to populate the world with a superior Aryan race. Therefore, the idea of having a mother deliver more than one child with every pregnancy became an interesting issue for them, and Mengele was willing and was interested in doing the research.
Many of these twins died in the experiments. You and your sister Miriam did not.
That's correct.
How did you survive?
My understanding is really that you needed two things in Auschwitz to survive: luck and an unbelievable will to live. Luck you cannot control, but I definitely had the unbelievable will to live.
There was much death around you. You saw plenty of children who died in your months in the camp.
Yes, death was everywhere. Dying was very, very easy. I do believe that most of us human beings are endowed genetically with the will to do everything to survive. I am not exactly sure why I had such an unbelievable will to live, but I did. I was even injected with a deadly germ by Joseph Mengele, and he stood by my bed and declared that I had only 2 weeks to live. I made a silent pledge that I will prove him wrong, that I will survive and be reunited with Miriam. Any time in my life that I have difficulties, I always say, well, it's not as bad as being between life and death in Auschwitz.
Do you remember the day, 60 years ago now, when the camp was liberated?
Yes, we were the battlefield for the Nazis for almost 3 weeks. The Nazis came back to Birkenau, which is Auschwitz II. They blew up the gas chamber, the crematorium, and they marched us in a death march to Auschwitz I, which is about 4 kilometers, about an hour's walk. They were shooting anybody who couldn't walk fast enough. Then we were on our own again. We were the battlefield. The bullets were flying, the artillery. As the Allies were closing in and the Nazis were not willing to give up. And one day we woke up and it was silent. And we wondered, is this the day that we are finally going to be free? And what shape will that freedom take? We waited for quite some time. It was early afternoon when one of the women went outside and looked around, and she began yelling at the top of her voice, "We are free! We are free! We are free!" Well, we all followed, and I wanted to see what she was talking about. I couldn't see very well because it was snowing very heavily. So I stood there at the door of the barracks. Then finally I could see some white images approaching. The Soviet army was camouflaged in white raincoats from top to bottom, and I could make out their faces. When they got close enough, we ran up to them. They gave us hugs, cookies, and chocolate. And this was the first sign of kindness, of humanity, that I had in a very long time. We began jumping up and down also to realize that we somehow triumphed over this unbelievable evil, that we have beaten the odds and we have survived.
By 1950, you were in Israel. 1960, you married an American tourist, Michael Kor,
yes,
also a concentration camp survivor. You lived in Terre Haute, Indiana for a long time. You opened a museum, a Holocaust museum in Terre Haute.
Correct.
In the 90s, in 2003... it was attacked by an arsonist who wrote, "Remember Timothy McVeigh," on the side of the museum. What was the meaning of that? Was this a hate crime?
It definitely was not a love crime. Timothy McVeigh, he was executed or put to death in Terre Haute, Indiana. Timothy McVeigh was a white supremacist. And this person or these people obviously were sympathizers of Timothy McVeigh. Well, that does not make me feel very good, the idea that anybody would destroy a little modest, very modest museum that has a huge marquee, and the marquee says, "Let us remove all hatred and prejudice from this world and let it begin with me.
And I know that you're rebuilding that museum now.
Yes, we are.
Eva Kaur, you've said that you feel no bitterness about what happened, that you've forgiven the Nazis, you've forgiven Mengele, you've forgiven everything. Please explain that to us.
Well, when somebody is a victim of any crime, of any tragedy, there are only two choices. One can become angry and want to take out revenge action against the perpetrators. That, unfortunately, or even the idea of bringing them to justice. Bringing a person to justice does not do one single thing for the victim. Not that those people should not be held responsible, but the victim will be left with the pain. And the only way that I have found, and accidentally I stumbled on it, was when I met with a former Nazi doctor, Hans Munch. I, as a gesture of thanks for his willingness to document the operation at the gas chamber, I came up with the idea that in order to give him something meaningful, I would give him a letter, a simple letter from me to him of forgiveness. And then from there it evolved that I was challenged by my friends, if I am forgiving Munch, why not Mengele? So it evolved into forgiving everybody, which became a really important fact later on, realizing that whatever issue, whoever did whatever to me, I have forgiven. I don't have that baggage to deal with. I am free. When I stood in Auschwitz and I read my letter of declaration of amnesty and looked up to the sky in Auschwitz-Birkenau, I forgave everybody and I felt a sense of freedom that I have never felt before.
Eva Kaur, you will be standing in Auschwitz on this 60th anniversary.
Correct.
Spending the day there in Poland. What are you looking to observe these six decades after the liberation of this camp?
Well, I am, first of all, very gratified that so many countries will have representatives and finally acknowledged the importance of what happened there and the millions of people who have suffered as a result of it. But I am taking with me teachers and students, and the topic of our trip to Auschwitz is passing on the torch. I plan to be around for at least another 30, 40 years, but let's say that I don't. I want the lessons that I have learned, that it happened and why it happened, how to prevent hatred and prejudice, how people should never give up if they have difficulties in their life, because you can overcome unbelievable adversities. How to heal oneself, one soul. Nobody can help you heal yourself. It's not a religious issue. It's a human issue. It's a need to heal oneself. Forgiveness is actually a gift I give myself, not a gift I give the perpetrator. I am only concerned about the victims, how to help the victim. So that lesson and that message and that legacy I am passing on to my son, to teachers and students from the area.
Eva Moses Kaur, thank you for passing this torch on to all of us today.
You're welcome.
Eva Kaur and her sister Miriam survived Joseph Mengele's laboratory at Auschwitz. She spoke with me from her home at Terre Haute, Indiana. Tomorrow, on the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, she will be there passing the torch, as you hear. I'm joined from Washington by Peter Black, senior historian at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Peter Black, I have to say, in speaking with each of these three women, I was just so moved by that sort of fierce, beautiful will to live. And there in Eva Kaur's voice, that clarity and strength all these years later. You've heard so many of these stories of survivors. Each survivor must have dealt with this in his or her own way. Eva Kaur has embraced forgiveness. What's the range of reactions you've seen and heard over the years, and how common is this one, forgiveness?
Forgiveness is unusual, though certainly not unheard of. That is a total forgiveness, as expressed by Ms. Kaur in a very, very moving way. And it certainly is. I agree with her completely that the only people who have the ability or the capacity to offer forgiveness are the victims, certainly not the post-war generation, certainly not even the prosecutors who prosecute persons for crimes against humanity. This is something that only the victim can give. The reaction ranges from Ms. Kaur's reaction to extreme bitterness, to a philosophical satisfaction at having come through, to a sense of self-confidence. I mean, one of the reasons that we remember Auschwitz is that it took so much willpower, as Ms. Kaur mentioned, so much strength to struggle through what clearly was a hell on earth.
I also wanted to ask, we're talking with women tonight, older women now who were girls or young teenagers when they were in Auschwitz. Have you seen a difference in the way that men and women responded to the horror there, to the way that they've lived with the memories of that horror in their lives? Is there a gender breakdown?
I don't know if that really, if I could really pick out a gender breakdown in the response, because it is so individual. It doesn't matter how many survivors that I've had the privilege to talk to. Each survivor, man or woman, or who was a child at the time or who was a young adult at the time, had a different way of dealing with these issues. And it's extremely difficult to figure out how they work this out beyond what they tell us, which undoubtedly is as honest as can possibly be.
Oh, and you can hear the honesty there. I should say for our listeners, Eva Kaur's twin sister Miriam did make it out of Auschwitz with her, as you heard there, and lived for many years, eventually died in the United States in 1993. It's the trip she's taking back to Auschwitz tomorrow, Eva, is not her first. You heard her there saying that she'd stood there before and made her own personal declaration of amnesty, Peter Black, and shouting to the heavens, "I am free."
Oh. And I believe her completely on this. The power of forgiveness is really something that's immeasurable. And this is not to say that someone who is a survivor who cannot work his or her way to that kind of full forgiveness or amnesty does not have equal strength in another way. But certainly forgiveness is an incredible, liberating development.
And an astonishing thing to be able to come to. Peter Black, please stand by. We're talking tonight on the 60th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi death camp at Auschwitz with three remarkable women, remarkable survivors of the Holocaust of Auschwitz. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, that is tomorrow, with three women who, as children, survived the Holocaust, and with Peter Black, senior historian at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. Our final memories tonight come from Erica Mendelson in Brooklyn, New York. She was 14 when she arrived with her older sister Ruth at Auschwitz. It was one of many stops for the two sisters. After 60 years, this was the first interview Mendelssohn has given about her experience in the Holocaust. I asked her whether her Jewish family recognized the danger when the Nazis first came to power.
No, I don't think so. I didn't think that even entered their mind, because my father lost his leg in the First World War.
As a soldier?
As a soldier,
mm-hmm.
Yes. And
so he had given Germany. Something mm-hmm,
yes.
For Germany.
And he didn't think that anything could ever happen to him. Or to all of us. But on Kristallnacht, November 9th of 1938, we lived right next to the temple.
Mm-hmm.
They burned the temple. Ooh. And they came in and they arrested my father. He was in prison for about a week, and they told him if we don't leave Königsberg, that he would be sent to Dachau.
Did he understand what that meant? What did he think Dachau was?
I think they gave him the idea that he would be imprisoned, probably for life or maybe killed. I think they put it pretty straight to him. I was only 8 years old, so I didn't really understand that much of it. But I remember my mother, my father, everybody was crying. So we had to pick ourselves up, and we moved to Berlin.
In March 1942, the Nazis came to your apartment and put the family on a train to Terezin.
Yes.
It's the so-called model concentration camp near Prague.
Oh, yes, model.
What was life like there?
We had to work. You know, like I was saying, I was only 12 at the time, and we had to work for our keep, and we had little carts that we were standing in line for food for, and all in all, it wasn't that terrible, but still people were being tortured, and everything, of course, was hushed up. I was in a youth home, so I was helping out there with the younger children and cleaning up. And all. We were all separated except my mother, my father, and my youngest sister, who was two.
There were four sisters. Then came November 1944, and you and your older sister Ruth were taken out of Terezin and sent where?
Sent to Auschwitz. Yes, we were put back in the cattle car and sent to Auschwitz. We had no idea where we were going, but rumors were there that we were going someplace, not knowing anything about gas chambers or crematorium, anything. So after quite a few days, we got there. We all got off the trains with only what we had on, and there was the gates that says Arbeit macht frei. And there was Dr. Mengele standing there, and he was pointing to people to go to one side or the other side. We had no idea which side it would be. People were crying, and children were taken away from the parents, and it was just horror. It was just a sheer horror. And somehow my sister was able to pull me along to the side that she was pointed to, which was a very lucky thing because the other side was the gas chamber.
You were in Auschwitz for just 2 weeks.
Just 2 weeks, yes.
What was your experience there?
I guess the worst. First of all, we were put into showers and we were shaven. Our head, everything was shaven off. Our clothes and our IDs, everything was taken away. And that was the lucky thing for me that there was a person who said, "How old are you?" I said, 14. She said, "Never say 14. Just tell them you're 18, otherwise you're not going to make it here." So from that moment on, I was 18. And then they sent us into the showers, and that's when we heard that we are lucky that water comes out of here, because on the other side, gas came out of the showers.
And that was the first you really learned
about the death camp. We didn't know about that before.
During your time there, were you further aware that people were dying? Could you tell?
Definitely. People were dying all around us. And, of course, you smelled the smoke of the crematorium. People were being burned, and then people started talking about it. And we were in barracks, terrible barracks, a lot of people in it, because this was supposed to be the final solution, that they put more and more people into these death camps. They gave us no food or anything, just once in a while a little tiny piece of bread, while the capos, the people that were running it, they were baking bread for themselves and they were having fun. We had to then get one dress. We got no underwear, no hats, no coats. That was in November.
Cold.
And it was, you know, this part near Poland, and it was very, very cold. And when they counted and somebody maybe died and they couldn't find them, we had to stay outside, sometimes for 10 hours, sometimes for 20 hours or more. People were freezing around us, falling down, dying. Then when they brought us back in, we had to get undressed completely. And Dr. Mengele, with his SS, came in and looked around for more people that they could eliminate, like pregnant women and older people that somehow slipped through. And I was always shaking because I thought they're going to find out that I'm so young and they're going to take me away. My sister and I were always worried about that. This happened almost every day because they were waiting for people to get weak so they could take them out. As soon as they saw a pregnant woman, they took them out, and who knows whatever happened. Maybe she had the baby. Maybe they probably made experiments on the babies. But after 2 weeks, they finally put us into a cattle car again, and they brought us to Oederan, which was near Dresden in Germany, mm-hmm. to a labor camp. Mm-hmm. But Auschwitz was something you can really never, never forget.
Now you have a granddaughter who's 14 years old, the age that you
yes,
were then.
I have two granddaughters that are both 14.
When you look at them, you must remember yourself as a young girl
right.
wonder how such a young girl could survive such a situation.
Because I look at them, I said, they couldn't survive this. It's impossible. Because I didn't know I was that strong. I guess nobody really did that survive, knew that they were that strong. Because you'd be surprised, and everybody would be surprised, how much you really want to live. And therefore push and push ahead every day.
When the Red Cross finally came, you were liberated, you weighed 70 or 80 pounds.
Yes.
That's somewhere close to death at that age.
And close to typhoid, too. Yeah, we all wound up with typhoid, and we were quarantined, which was in Terezin. They sent us back to Terezin.
We were finally back there. Erica Mendelssohn,
yes.
Now here we are 60 years after the end of that horrible experience, unspeakable.
Yeah.
It's a long time to think about what happened there, your own experience and the overall experience. What conclusions, what insights about human beings, about human society have you taken away from it?
It's unbelievable that any society, no matter how mean and miserable, that they can do things like that to human beings. And I just hope the heavens that this can never happen again.
How often do you think about what happened then? Does it come to mind every day, every week, every month? Do you block it out?
I tried to block it out. There were times when I blocked it out completely.
For years? For a long time?
Yeah, pretty much so. But as I get older, things start coming back more vividly. And I just hope and pray that nothing will ever happen like that again. And I'm afraid if it does, not for myself, but for my children, my grandchildren, and their children.
What should have happened then to prevent this from happening?
I don't think anything could have happened, really, to prevent it. If maybe more people would have been aware of it, maybe people could have been fighting it, for us. But I don't think people were aware of it. And ignorance is your worst enemy. So we really have to be very much aware of everything around us to make sure that things like that don't happen again.
Erica Mendelssohn, thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. You're very welcome.
Erica Mendelssohn on her experience during the Holocaust. She spoke with me from Brooklyn, New York. 6 million Jews died in the Nazi camps, 1.5 million maybe at Auschwitz and Birkenau, 6 million in the Holocaust, along with several million others, including Soviet prisoners of war, gypsies, homosexuals, political opponents of the Nazis. I'm joined tonight by Peter Black. He's senior historian at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Peter Black, out of all those millions and the smaller number that survived, we're hearing just from three tonight. You're a historian. You've heard many stories from that time. What strikes you in the stories in general, in the stories that we're hearing tonight?
Well, with the stories that we hear, we always have to remember that it is a relatively small representation of the stories that occurred, mm-hmm. Because so many millions died and clearly aren't around to tell their stories anymore. But the stories of the people who did survive are important to us because we can not only admire and honor their strength to endure such suffering and such hell. But it helps us, and this is a key goal of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, to educate ourselves, to educate people through the dissemination of accurate information about the Holocaust, to an awareness of the dark potential to which intolerance on the basis of race, religion, national origin, political opinion, or physical and mental disability can lead. In fact, the importance of Auschwitz is developing a sense that Auschwitz is the potential of every state-sponsored or even state indulgence of intolerance on any of these bases.
You're right. The irony here tonight is that we're hearing these stories, but overall this isn't a story of survival. The story of the Holocaust is a story of death.
It is a story of mass death. And it is a story that did not begin with the Nazis, and it hasn't ended, unfortunately, in 1945. But it is much more a part of our political and intellectual world. And one thing, for instance, recently the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum made an open statement warning about the potential for genocide in Darfur, and we like to hope that it contributed to a determination to investigate thoroughly what was happening in Sudan in order to prevent a further loss of life from occurring.
But clearly, as terrible as these stories are, the memory of the Holocaust is not proving to be anything like a perfect firewall against genocide.
No, that it is not. And it took... If you want to make a comparison, it took an awful long time for we Americans, for instance, to get rid of the institution of slavery, and yet another 100 years to break down, at least legally, discrimination. The Nazi assault on human dignity throughout Europe did lead to the development of a functional international tribunal to prosecute persons for perpetrating crimes against humanity. And in fact, the notion of a crime against humanity was established with the Nuremberg trial in 1945-1946. Since that time, the ability and the jurisdiction of not only the United States but many other nations to try individuals who perpetrate crimes against humanity has increased, and while it's a slow process, it still is a process, nonetheless, that is ongoing.
Well, Peter Black at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, I want to thank you very much for spending this time with us this evening and hearing these stories together.
It was an honor to be here. Thank you.
And I want to say how personally moved and honored I was to speak with Sonja Schreiber-Weitz, Eva Kaur, and Erica Mendelssohn, survivors of Auschwitz, survivors of the Holocaust, very bright spirits against all odds. We're going to close this hour with the Yiddish song Sunbeams, written by Joseph Wolff while a prisoner at Auschwitz. After the war, he settled in Berlin, where he made this recording. He committed suicide in 1974. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Neshumes flamen vidizun allen reißen brechen trotz der Pein. Weil es flattert scheu, rot die Fuhr von der Freiheit.